Hey, Splainers. On today's episode, our guest is someone who works at Planned Parenthood, and while we don't shy away from that fact, we just wanted to let you all know that he's not here as an official representative of Planned Parenthood, but just as an expert in women's health. Thanks. Enjoy the episode.
I need a lady's opinion, 'cause I'm not a lady like a lady is.
Are you still recording? Mm-hmm. Is this going to be the podcast?
No.
just we're going to definitely put it in there.
Yeah. Just like.
Oh, that's good. This water's so great.
Hey, here we go. Hey, everyone. Welcome back for another week of the Womansplaining Podcast. I am Ray, and I am joined as always by
Melissa
and Cheryl.
And we have a guest with us today. Jay has joined us. Jay is a nurse practitioner at Planned Parenthood, and he has joined us to answer some of your questions about women's health.
Yeah, he's written in quite a few times to kind of correct some of the things that we've assumed or great comments before, so we're excited that he's here today.
Yeah, he's the only one who is allowed to mansplain vaginas to us because he's a medical health professional.
He's seen more than we have.
We could call it health-splaining.
Yes, health-splaining.
Oh, that's a good one.
Love it.
I like that.
First of all, tell us about yourself, your background, what made you interested in this field of health?
So I have been a nurse practitioner for about 6.5 years, and I've actually spent my whole career as a nurse practitioner at Planned Parenthood here in the state of Utah. And I initially got into women's health because they hired me. I was applying for every nurse practitioner job I could find in the top half of the state, and they're the ones who gave me the first offer, and I took it. And in nursing school, I actually really hated women's health. It seemed like a really terrible fit for me.
And as a
male nursing student, I had a lot of sort of unpleasant experiences with patients who didn't want me in the room. And I've had some rough social edges that needed to be knocked off with things not to say. So it didn't seem like it would be a great fit. But once I got hired, it's been really great, and it actually ended up being a good niche for me to fall into. So I really enjoyed
that. That's awesome. Do you ever still feel like there are women who are like, oh, I don't really want a male nurse? Like, is there a female like nurse practitioner here who can help me? Do you still get that feeling?
It happens occasionally, less than you might think. So I've done tens of thousands of pelvic exams, and maybe a few times a year I have a patient in my clinic who says that they don't want to be seen because I'm a male. I think most of the time, if you have a professional degree attached to your name and they know that you have expertise in the field, then it's not just, hey, I'm having this guy look at my lady parts. And I think once I'm done with the interaction with the patient, they feel confident and it works out just fine. So
I'm always surprised when friends are asking like for OB or, you know, tell me your doctor, I need a new one. How many of them are like giving male names because I have that, like, I'm like, no, well, ladies can look at me. That's fine.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about that before where we're all like,
I would prefer
a female doctor. Just that's like my preference, but not to say that obviously.
Mine probably just comes from like a background of needing therapy from experiences though.
Yeah. I think it's just all like a body image issues. Like, I think now that I'm older, I probably wouldn't care. But when I first started going, I was like, oh, nope, I need a female doctor.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, and part of it's probably also the fact that working at Planned Parenthood, a lot of our patient population are low income, can't afford to be seen at a regular women's health clinic.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think that our service keeps them coming back afterward.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I used Planned Parenthood in college. Loved it. Great experiences.
So give us just a really quick overview of what some of the services that Planned Parenthood provides.
So Planned Parenthood in general in the state of Utah provides general women's health care with the specific focus of family planning services. So our goal is to enable women who do not want to have children currently for whatever reason, whether it's school or financial purposes or because they don't have a relationship that they want to result in a pregnancy. We enable those women to prevent pregnancy until they're ready to have kids. And we do have one clinic that provides abortion services. And we believe that's an important part of whole women's health care. But my job specifically doesn't involve abortions, except as it regards counseling patients about their options for abortion and providing informed consent. But my general job, as far as, you know, a day in the life of Jay, the nurse practitioner, is to provide annual preventive exams with pap smears. I do exams for women who have symptoms. Most of the time, that's either discharge or some sort of weird bump that they're worried about. We do testing and treatment for sexually transmitted infections. And I do a lot of placements of IUDs and contraceptive implants.
Cool. Yes, I'm an IUD fan. Number one IUD fan over here. So here's some of our questions from our Facebook listeners. What is the worst thing you've seen inside someone?
Okay. So...
that chuckle.
All right. So foreign body removals are some of the most interesting and entertaining visits. And you get a few a year. And I'm at the point now where...
I am just happy... that you were saying a few a year.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not an all-the-time thing.
Well, I'm assuming they're going to the emergency room if they're not able to schedule an appointment with
Most of the time,
that's true. Maybe they'll see more than
so
we are.
Most of the time, it's a retained tampon or retained condom.
Retained, meaning just like
Somebody put a tampon in and they forgot it was in there, and then they put a new tampon in and kind of shoved the one that was in there up farther.
Wait,
and
so
then 3 weeks later,
know?
Or like double tampon.
Sometimes they suspect and sometimes they have no idea. So I've gotten kind of a sixth sense for retained tampons where like I can kind of know based on their symptoms that I should take a biohazard bag and a pair of forceps in with me.
Oh my, stop.
But
do you have like a little flashlight?
Well, I have an exam bike. It's not like I'm using a head reflector like the old days, you know. Yeah, so most of the time it's retained tampons, and most of the time the patients are extremely embarrassed about it, as you can imagine. And so, you know, 90% of it is just saying, oh, no, this happens all the time. Don't worry about it. It's nothing to be embarrassed about. It happens to everyone kind of a thing. But so most of the time it's retained tampons or retained condom bits. But I did have one patient... Well, because sometimes they break and you have pieces stuck in there.
I think I've told this before, but my first experience with even knowing or like understanding or anything what a condom was the movie Grease. Mm-hmm. When Rizzo's using it in the car and outside the car, another character breaks the window of another car and then Rizzo was like, oh, the condom broke. And so I thought that condoms were made from glass.
Oh, my God. I love you.
For a long time.
Oh,
because
stop.
I was like, that's the same.
Your sex ed condo. From Greece.
Yeah. There's a lot of sex ed in Greece. Most of it.
It's
not bad, but pretty bad. Anyway,
I've always hated that movie. I'm sorry.
A residual condom piece in my head as a 12-year-old was a shard of a glass.
Sounds
horrifying.
Really awful.
So
is there anything else?
Okay. Condoms, those are pretty
so
standard.
The most entertaining one, though, was I had someone come up, and the only thing she complained about was having pain with intercourse, and I put the speculum in, and... So the tampon inserter, like the top part, the business end, she had that half of the plastic inserter wedged sideways all the way at the back of her vagina, and it took two pair of forceps and a lot of work to get it out.
Oh.
And she had no idea it was up there.
Did she have any explanation for like how that could have possibly happened?
She tripped and fell while
she sneezed. No, I mean, I didn't ask. I said, oh,
can you please explain this, ma'am?
That's some vigorous sex.
Ma'am, this is
like shove it sideways.
This is physically impossible. Like, you've defied the laws of physics with like the insertion of this. Explain this to me.
Maybe she was trying to use it as an IUD. Like, if I push this high enough, it will block my cervix.
Yeah, and the hardest removal I ever had was someone used a Diva cup that was the wrong size.
Like
was
too small?
Very, too big.
Oh, no.
Yes, it was really challenging to remove. And it's fun because I train new providers for Planned Parenthood. And the first time they have a retained tampon removal, I get a call about how gross it was. It's
like
you get
like
a gold star now, you're in the club.
So. Without going to like full level of grossness.
It's
got to
be pretty
like,
stanky.
What, is that? The gross part that you're like the smell, or does it like change its consistency?
No, it's the smell. So they end up how much old disgustingness do you guys want on?
Oh yeah, every detail.
I'm ready for
so if a tampon's been in there for a while, it kind of looks like a dead mouse in a way because it turns kind of gray, and you end up getting a whole lot of really gross smelling yellow discharge.
Oh my God, stop. Okay.
So it has the same sort of description from the patient as if they had like a trichomonas infection because it's just this profuse, really gross smelling discharge. But you kind of can get from the history of how long it's been and what's been going on that it could have been a tampon.
I can tell you approximately how dead this tampon is.
So this one died 3 weeks ago.
So you just take it out and you put it right in a biohazard bag and seal it up. Yeah. But it's still, as soon as you put the speculum in, the whole room starts to be very
fragrant.
Very odorous. So and as I said, it's kind of mortifying for the patients, I think.
Yeah,
they,
for sure.
It's not like they don't notice the odor. And so there's a lot of reassurance that goes with that.
Yeah.
My boss said that she had a patient come in where she pulled some grapes out of her vagina during the exam, and she just laughed and said, oh, I guess he left some in there.
Oh, no.
But, fermented.
Yeah. Just making some homebrew, right?
That's not how you make wine, everybody. Don't do it.
As far as the worst thing I've seen, though, it wasn't a retained object. I had a patient that was in her late 20s and she'd never had kids, and she had had a pap test that came back abnormal, I think 2 years previously, and wasn't able to afford to get the colposcopy she needed, the biopsy she needed. And so she came in, and again, her main concern was just she'd been having some pain with intercourse, and I put the speculum in and her cervix. She had really obviously advanced cervical cancer, and her cervix was basically half gone already from the cancer. It was really traumatic for me. I hadn't been in practice for very long, and so I had to just leave and kind of go into the lab and collect myself and figure out what I was going to say to her. But
that's not funny at all,
man. Yeah. So we got her referred to get the biopsies and send her over to the to Huntsman to get work done. And I never found out what happened after that. I'm not even sure if she is still here.
Oh, man. That's so sad.
I mean, what do you do? I mean, like, the healthcare system is pretty screwed up, but, like, I mean, what do you do when you just, like, can't afford the next step in procedure, you know? Like,
yeah. Well, most of the time, it's not that they can't afford it. It's that they don't have the information they need to get the affordable care. So we have some resources that we can point people to. You know, if you have an abnormal pap test that's bad enough that you need a biopsy done, we can do those with Planned Parenthood at our Salt Lake clinic, but they cost a few hundred dollars. I don't want to quote specific prices because, those are subject to change and whatnot. But, you know, they're not cheap. And especially for people who don't have insurance that are living maybe paycheck to paycheck, you know, convincing somebody that this abnormal pap is worth following up on at the expense of paying bills or paying for food, it's hard. Yeah. But I also know that there's, you know, a community clinic a couple miles from my clinic where you can get it for under $100. And so it's the biggest challenge, I think, for patients is not necessarily paying for services. It's knowing where they can get the affordable services.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think saying that if we have single payer healthcare, we're going to be rationing care and people are going to have to wait for services, that may be true in some cases. But right now we already ration care. We just say rich people get healthcare and poor people don't get healthcare.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I guess for, like, women out there listening, if you can't afford care, maybe even at least go to Planned Parenthood and just ask what your options are.
Yeah.
Like, see what's out there, see what's affordable. Like, don't just think like, oh, well, I can't afford it, so I shouldn't follow up on this, because that shit's important. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. There is a way.
And we have resources for family practice, for urology, for cardiology, endocrinology, anything you can think of that you would need to do, we have resources that we can point people to. But if you come to one of our clinics, for sure, if you need care that we can't provide, we're happy to point you to somewhere that you'd be able to afford.
So if you do know you have something stuck up there, you're saying don't go to the ER, just come to Planned Parenthood.
Don't go to the ER. Try and get it out yourself.
Yeah.
A lot of, I mean, it's, you know, the same thing you tell people if a woman's using the NuvaRing, like, it's a dead end up there. It's not going to get lost,
anywhere.
But in a lot of cases, especially if you have been having sex, for example, really recently, like, it's a little bit, the opening is a little bit more relaxed, a little more open. Even with just a flashlight, you may be able to kind of see in there. And, you know, you might not want to stick a pair of needle nose pliers or something in your vagina, but, you know, if you trust somebody, if you trust someone with access to your vagina, you could have them put a couple fingers up there and try and get it out. And it might not feel very good, but
loop it up.
But at least you get it out.
At least you get it out. And again, that's a pretty routine thing that we deal with at Planned Parenthood, and a lot of other clinics, I'm sure, are the same. But I've had patients go to the ER for things that should be really easy to fix, and they just do not know what they're doing with women's health much of the time.
If women understood their bodies more, you know, or men too, like, just, like, knew and were aware of the space and everything, it would cause a lot less panic, I think.
Yeah. I'm not sure if we want to get anybody, especially me, started on Utah sex education right now. But that whole
people aren't aware of their own bodies
because if we tell them about their bodies, they'll use them to have babies when they shouldn't is kind of overblown fear, I think.
Yeah, I hate that attitude of like, don't give anyone any knowledge because then it's dangerous and they'll use it for
sex. Don't tell them that drugs exist. They'll just do them.
Yeah. And then we have movies in our houses where they're watching people drink alcohol and do drugs and have sex. And it's like, well, it's not like we're not giving them an idea of what it is, but.
Or we're giving the Hollywood idea or the incorrect idea. Yeah. We're telling them that condoms are made of glass.
Yeah. or even worse, they're getting their ideas about what sex should be like from porn.
Yeah.
Right. And then it's like, you know, if you turn the sound off and don't know what they're doing, I think you would not think that those women were enjoying themselves.
Not with a glass condom.
Yeah, that is very true.
Yeah, but we have parents in Utah that won't even let their kids do the maturation class in fifth grade to find out.
Oh, I remember those kids.
Puberty.
Yeah.
And I was like,
how are you going to deal with your period when it comes?
Yeah.
If we don't talk about it, she'll never have one.
God, I wish that was the case.
That's the thing.
The scary thing is it's like, you know, it's not because those parents are like, well, I want to handle this like with my kid. Like, I'll talk to them about it. It's because like, they're like, I don't want to talk to them about it, but I don't want anyone else talking to them about it either.
I don't want anyone putting ideas in my kids' heads.
Or science.
Because then kids having kids.
You know, science.
Yeah. And it's like, I can't get pregnant because the moon is full kind of stuff. And or worse yet, you know, thinking about if you have a daughter and you're worried about her having sex because you teach her about it, think about how much easier it's going to be for some, you know, ill-meaning young lad to convince her that she should have sex with him because she can't get pregnant the first time, which is something I've heard.
Oh my
many
God.
Patients say.
So many.
Or, you know, or it's, like it's okay. Yeah. It's okay. Yeah. I'll pull out. Or I don't like condoms. They just don't feel that good. And they just.
Well, fucking use your hand then. I'm sure that feels great.
Yeah, but it's not just a question of not knowing about your own body or not knowing about how baby making works. It's more an issue that I don't think we're raising young people to be assertive enough to want to get consent or ask for consent. And so we end up with these really coercive sexual relationships that happen where, you know, sex is the way that I tell him I love him. And you know, this kind of ridiculous, you know, inability to really stand up for yourself. And, you know, I'll have patients come in who are getting their, let's say, getting an arm implant out, which is basically the most effective hormonal method we have right now. And they're getting it out because they're having side effects, and that's reasonable. And their plan afterward is condoms. And you say, okay, so... you know, I can tell from their chart that they've had a new partner, let's say, in the last couple months. And talking over how that conversation is going to go, you know, do you feel comfortable asking somebody to put a condom on? Do you have an expectation that he's going to bring a condom or do you bring up that he should have a condom? Do you plan sex ahead of time or is it a spur of the moment thing? And in a lot of cases, they haven't really thought it through. They're just like, oh, maybe if I cross my fingers, I won't get pregnant. Mm-hmm. But especially younger people, you know, junior high and high school aged women, I think of them as little girls because I have a daughter, but, you know, it's really kind of a scary thing to not be in a position to feel like you can bring that up with a partner and have an expectation that they're going to keep you safe. And he's not the one that's going to get pregnant. And until society decides that we are going to punish and shame men for getting women pregnant, the same way we punish women for getting pregnant, I think, especially with our young women, giving them the information they need to really be able to say no confidently, I think is super important. And that's what's mostly lacking, I think, in our sex ed right now.
Oh, yeah. Even adult women have a hard time advocating for themselves. Like, we've talked about this before where we're just like, oh, it's awkward. So I'm just going to, like, I'll just kind of laugh and, like, ignore it and not say anything because you don't want to be difficult and you don't want to, like, we're sort of socialized to be not difficult and accommodating. And if you are contrary to that, then it's like, oh, well, she's just a bitch. And it's like, no, she's advocating for her own sexual well-being.
Or especially like if you have your own condoms with you, like I think there is like this idea that you're like a whore or, oh, you're just like ready for sex at any time.
Or if you have them, you want sex. Uh-huh. And you're like, no, I have these for when I do want sex. It doesn't mean it's with
like
you.
I owe you.
And I can't, and like I don't maybe trust like the dude to always bring the condom.
Because we're not messing around.
Yeah. We'd put two on if we could, y'all.
If you don't like my condoms, bring your own, doofus.
Absolutely. He's like, I already have one on. Great, here's another one. Yeah. I don't know where you bought that.
Just double up. Double up.
How long has it been in your wallet?
Can I add a quick PSA about condoms?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I don't know how many of your other listeners are of the man persuasion like I am, but...
One other.
Okay, just so this is, for that one man. That one man that listens and needs condoms. So a lot of condoms are really, really terrible. Okay, so they're too tight or they're too thick or you don't like the lube or they have, you know, ribbed for her pleasure, you know, or tingles for him and her. Like, there are a lot of reasons why condoms can kind of really suck. And, you know, if you have a problem with condoms breaking or slipping off, they're the wrong size. If you have a problem with a condom not giving you the sensation you want, get a different condom. Like, totally. This is the age of the internet. They have websites that'll give you instructions on how to measure your penis so that you get a condom that's the right size, so that you know how many millimeters circumference you have.
What? Is it like small, medium, large?
Yeah, large, extra large. Yeah. And
they don't want any of that small, medium bullshit. Yeah, you're large, you know, or extra large.
If all you're used to is the condoms you see at the grocery store, and you're like, well, I can either get, you know, Trojan or Durex, or I can... be Kroger. Really fancy, really fancy, okay. And you know, pay a little extra and get the lambskin ones, which
those freak me out.
Yeah, but they're not bad. Like, they transfer heat really well. They just smell a little weird, and the lube is a little weird too. And it's basically, you know, an animal's intestine you're putting on your penis.
Okay, but, that's a lot.
Well, what's worse, an animal's intestine or processed tree sap?
You tell me.
Anyway. I'll take some tree sap.
I know, me too.
You know how much I love chemicals.
Yeah, so if you don't like condoms, find better condoms, guys. It's better than risking a pregnancy or worse, like chlamydia or gonorrhea, and then you've got a yellow waterfall coming from your penis. Like,
that's worse, y'all. Anyway. That's worse. So, I love that message, though, for guys where it's like, if you've tried one and you don't like it, try another one, because that's what women have to do with birth control. Like, we're like, we tried the pill. Well, that didn't really work. There was side effects. We tried a different pill.
Yeah.
That wasn't great. Okay, then we went to the implant, or like we did the IUD, and like that caused some problems. Like, we have to constantly be kind of finding out what works for us. And so, like,
and our bodies change over time too. Yeah. So, like, sometimes stuff just stops working very well after many years of it working great.
So it's like, take some responsibility. And if you're just like, like a condom doesn't feel good, like, figure your shit out, dude. You know?
Neither does pregnancy.
Yeah.
Like, don't be a jerk.
Not great.
Yeah. And most of my patients are women. I do see men. I only see men if they have symptoms, which usually, again, bumps or discharge. So I'm not as sympathetic to the man side of things as I might otherwise be. Like, I tell patients on a regular basis, like, I don't care about your partner. Like, if he can feel your IUD strings,
who cares?
If you're not telling him he has to wear a condom, he can deal with feeling the strings. Like, as long as he's not getting poked by the actual IUD, like, just tell him to stop whining and man up. Like, you're letting him have sex with you.
Fuck yeah.
You're letting him in.
That's crazy. So, especially young people saying, well, he says he doesn't like condoms. Like, you can sell him you don't like having sex without one. Like, and there are some women who don't like the sensation of having sex with a condom. I'm not going to say this is only a man thing, but...
Yeah, that's fair. Second question from Facebook. What is the worst STD? This is how these conversations go. Right. Very freeform. Don't worry
about it. Second question. Shoot.
What's the worst STD to catch, and what's the most common?
Well, HIV, right? That one kills you.
I mean, it depends. So as far as the worst one to actually live with, it's hard to say. Like, there are STDs that basically have no long-term bad effects, like genital warts. They don't look great and they kind of bother people. And if they're in the wrong place, they can rub against clothing. But there really isn't a long-term terrible health effect from having genital warts. Hmm. So, you know, genital warts, molluscum contagiosum is even more benign. It's like, okay, you have bumps, they'll go away on their own. Don't even worry about it. You got them through sex, but who cares? You know, we can burn them off with acid if you want, but that's
probably more worse painful than having than just them.
Most of the time. Ugh. So for people with normal immune systems, most STDs are not going to cause significant long-term problems, particularly for men. But the issue with all of them is that even the ones that are generally fairly easy to treat, like chlamydia and gonorrhea, you treat with a single dose of antibiotics. Trichomonas, you treat with a single dose of antibiotics. But if you leave them untreated, they can lead to pelvic inflammatory disease. They can lead to infertility. You can get tubal scarring from them, even from having it once. Ooh. And so it depends on what you mean. Like, if the long-term effect you're worried about is death, HIV is the worst. because that can actually kill you. Although we've had, you know, we have treatments that are really effective and people with HIV live basically completely normal lives now, as long as they have access to medication. Herpes is the one everybody worries about, but with herpes, you can have these painful sores that come up. They last for a week or two and then they go away, but that's not going to kill you. You know, yeah. If you're pregnant, you need to worry about it when you give birth, but they're the real long-term risk with the STDs that everybody worries about is just the issue of infertility and infection going higher up. The one that really is most common, I think, is HPV, partially because in the U.S., the uptake of the HPV vaccine hasn't been as complete as it is other places. I think there's still some stigma attached to it where you're like, oh, why are we vaccinating against something they're getting through sex? My daughter's not going to have sex.
Ever.
But it causes cervical cancer. Like more research we have into it, most cervical cancers are caused by HPV, if not all. This isn't a topic I'm an expert in, but I've, you know, learned some about it. You know, HPV is fairly easy to prevent with this vaccine. But if you don't get the vaccine and you get HPV, that's one of the high risk strains, like 16 or 18, especially right now, you can get cervical cancer. Jeez. And most people don't die of cervical cancer in the U.S. if they have adequate health care and are getting regular PAPs. But at least in the U.S., you know, we seem to be a little wary again of saying, oh, I'm going to give you a vaccine to save you from this thing you get through sex. But you don't know who your, you know, monogamous virginal daughter is going to marry. And HPV is very common. Most people, if they've had more than one partner in their lives, you know, if they have a regular sex life, are going to get it sometime. And most of the time, it's not going to cause any major issues. But that's the one, I guess, with the most significant long-term issue, sort of, maybe. Yeah. That was a long answer.
Good vaccine.
No, that's a great answer. I was just going to say, don't make me get on a vaccine soapbox because people who are just like,
is there room on your box for two?
Yeah.
Anyway, I guess the other one that could have some major issues is syphilis. It's not as prevalent in Utah, at least with the women having sex with men who don't have sex with other men category. Most of the syphilis we see in Utah is with men who have sex with other men or bisexual men or women who have sex with bisexual men. And if you don't treat syphilis and you don't know you have it, it can lead to really, really bad neurological problems and death, I think. Yeah. And it can get really awful. So you can get neurosyphilis is what you get in the end if it's untreated and it goes into your central nervous system, and it can be awful.
So
okay.
Worst STD, obviously HIV, most common HPV, but also that can have really bad long-term effects. So like just everyone get the vaccine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And cool. Get your kids
vaccinated. And get your PAP test. I know they're not comfortable. At least I've been told they're not comfortable. So
vaccinate girls and boys.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because so
I think that needs to be clear.
Your son doesn't have a cervix, right? But he's going to have sex in most cases with people who do have a cervix. And let's just all be safe, guys. It's the vaccine's been around for a long time, has a really good safety record. I know every vaccine has potential risks to it, but it's such an easy thing to prevent. I mean, 90-something percent of the cervical cancers are still caused by the 16 and 18 and the other high-risk strains that are in Gardasil. They keep adding more strains to Gardasil as they become more, you know, a higher percentage of the cervical cancer cases. And it's just so easy.
Do it.
Get vaccinated. Whatever.
What is your opinion of the best birth control? That's probably a loaded question because it depends on the person.
I love this question. And so, but I have an opinion though.
Okay.
Because so birth control is a fun topic, and I love to rant about birth control because I love my job. And counseling women about birth control options is really fun because you have to take into account their menstrual history and other medical conditions they have and what they want. So. So the best birth control is the one you'll use correctly.
Yes.
And again, when we do birth control counseling, we take into account, we have a research validated approach. We have a conversation with patients about, the effectiveness of the methods, but what they want, how easy or hard they think it would be to use it. Like, I'm not going to tell somebody to use birth control pills if they're not going to remember to take pills. So, we try and suggest that women use the long-term reversible methods like IUDs and implants because they're so effective and you don't have to remember to do anything, but they're not for everybody. And you know, we can put IUDs in women of basically any age. So if any of you listeners out there have been told by some old-fashioned doctor that you can't have an IUD until you've had a baby, that is not true. But it really, the insertion works pretty much regardless of how old you are. But, you know, we suggest the longer-term options first. But for women that don't want them, anything that you're going to use correctly and be able to be successful on, we think is the best method for you. Now, for me personally, if I had a uterus and were worried about getting a baby in there, I'd use the NuvaRing. And the reason why, now, saying that I would use the NuvaRing, if you're buying it out in the wild, is quite expensive. If your insurance doesn't cover it or you don't have insurance. But at Planned Parenthood, we offer the ring for the low tens of dollars, let's say, way, way less than you'd get it, and almost as cheaply as we can offer birth control pills. And it's a really good mix of predictability with your periods and low side effects, low hormones, convenience. You can skip periods on it. You leave it in for 3 weeks at a time. You can take it out to have sex and rinse it off and put it back in. Like, it's really, really flexible.
Literally,
yeah. But it, you know, basically, as long as you're not really squeamish about putting something into your vagina, the NuvaRing is amazing. And as I tell patients all the time, if I were a woman, I'd be on the NuvaRing.
That's awesome. Holla.
Thanks. I was like,
Cheryl's a ring fan.
Now, that being said, you can't, certain health conditions, you know, make it so that you can't use estrogen. So if you can't use estrogen, then I would suggest an IUD for sure.
What hormone? Yeah, what hormones does the NuvaRing release? Because I know that like the Mirena, which is what I have, has a little bit of progesterone that it releases, like slow release.
Yeah. So the I don't know how into the weeds we want to go. So the hormonal IUD has levonorgestrel, which has been around for a long time, and the NuvaRing uses etanorgestrel. I'm not sure exactly if I pronounced that right, but it's the same one actually that's in the arm implant. But it's just a different progestin, but it also has estrogen in it. And most of the birth control pills and other combined birth controls use ethanol estradiol as their estrogen. And so the ring has the same type of estrogen as all the birth control pills, or the majority of the birth control pills do. And the estrogen is what gives you the menstrual regulation side of things. Mm. And then it just, the progesterone is what actually prevents pregnancy.
Gotcha. So for women who maybe don't do well on hormonal birth control, because I hear that a lot, like from people where they're just like, oh, it messes my hormones, or like my body gets all weird. What's the best option?
Again, that kind of depends. So a lot of women, when they say I don't do well on hormones, now some of them, I've had patients that have tried every hormonal method that exists and don't do well in any of them. But a lot of women, if they say they don't do well in hormones, they've tried a high-dose pill and had headaches or had nausea or had breast tenderness or had mood swings. Every woman's experience will be different.
Right. And every pill is different.
Yeah. But, you know, if you were using a, you know, you're on Lavora, which has, you know, a pretty androgenic progestin, and you get acne on it, we can switch it to Yasmin that has no androgenic effect. Your acne will go away. Like, there are different things that we can do to kind of tweak the birth control to make it so that whatever side effect you had is less likely to happen. Now, we can't guarantee anything, obviously, but you know, if you don't do well on the patch, you can try the ring. If you don't do well on pills, you can try an IUD. Like, in most cases, women who say they don't do well on hormones, I find if you find the right birth control, it does fine. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that everyone wants to be a guinea pig and say, yeah, I'm willing to experiment for a year. So if you're looking for a non-hormonal method, the copper IUD is the most effective. And it has the benefit of lasting for at least 12 years and being effective that whole time. Again, IUDs aren't right for everybody. But the copper IUD by far is the most effective non-hormonal method.
Why isn't birth control free?
Is it not?
I mean,
so
with insurance?
With insurance.
It depends. So
my type or what?
Yeah.
Well, okay. So abstinence is free. There's a lot that goes into that. So some of it has to do with the way our healthcare industry works. And some of it, I think, has a lot to do, and this may be a cynical view, but it has a lot to do with the fact that most of our legislators are men, and since they don't have to personally pay for it, they don't care. And since they, you know, so under the
that feels real. Yeah,
so under the Affordable Care Act, a lot of preventive services are supposed to be covered with no copay, and that includes some forms of birth control, not all. But you know, birth control, asking why birth control isn't free is like asking why food isn't free. Like, there's a cost to society to make the birth control. There's a cost to the pharmaceutical company of developing and researching the control and getting the FDA trials in place. And granted, once it's out of, once they lose the patent on it, other companies come in and make generic versions of it. But somebody still had to pay to put that together. It's not like we go to the grocery store and say, why aren't bananas free?
Right.
True. So, very
you
know,
the condom you put on the banana is not free either. Somebody had to make it.
I mean, that makes sense. But that's
why it's going to be like free options and more expensive if you have the money to
have
the nicer condom. You pay for it.
But, you know, if you think, as I do, that a lot of parts of our healthcare should be just part of, you know, being able to live in a first world industrialized country that cares about people, ostensibly, you know, that should include making it so that people who don't have the benefit of wealth can still plan their families the way they want to. You know, I think it's a little bit hypocritical to say, I'm not going to make birth control affordable for poor people, and at the same time kind of stigmatize poor women for having kids when you don't think they should, because you're, you know, a controlling middle-aged rich white guy.
Yeah. Oh, we could get deep into that. We're going to get into our Instagram questions now. So the first one is, what birth control devices are implanted and what are the differences between them?
So currently, now I'm really familiar with the birth control methods that we offer at Planned Parenthood, but implanted kind of can mean a couple different things. If you mean the ones that go in the body and stay in the body, there's the implant in the arm, which is Nexplanon, which is made by Merck. And then you have the copper IUD and the various hormonal IUDs. The only one that's in the body in a way that only a healthcare provider could take it back out is the arm implant. And once it's put in there, it's officially good, according to the FDA indication, for 3 years, I think, still. But there's research to show that it's good for 5. And then after those 5 years, you have it removed.
I just had a friend get her arm implant removed. And I guess, like, it gets in there and then it, like, kind of, like, you have to dig around.
It just settles
and
in.
And she was like, why is this taking so long? And they're just, like, in there digging around.
So let's be clear that if you go to somebody who's good at it, they don't have to dig around.
Like, really? They were saying, like, I think she had it for 3 years. And they even warned her before she went in. They were like, hey, just so you know, like, it's not usually a simple, like, 2-second thing. And she was like, oh, okay, whatever. But she was like, this is taking a weird amount of time.
So the body does build a kind of fibrous capsule around it in just about everybody, but it's not like that's a scary thing that we don't expect. It's just what the body does to things.
Oh, I know.
Sure.
The arm. And, you know, if you know what you're doing, you know how to trim it off. And if you make the incision in the right place and you have good technique, there's no digging. You don't have to, like, make a giant incision. You know, we're not cutting the arm, you know, cutting all the way through the arm and pulling the implant out of the bloody stump and stitching it back on. It's a fairly simple procedure. Again, if you know what you're doing. I've done hundreds and hundreds of removals, and that's one of the things that I'll unashamedly say I'm really great at is those implant removals. But so come to me.
That's a skill.
So it is, you know, a minor office procedure, and it can take a little while if you're being careful and patient about it, but it's not, you know, nobody dies from it so far.
You said something though I want to clarify. You said the only implant that needs a medical professional to remove is the arm implant. Are you saying people can remove their own IUDs?
Oh yeah. Oh, you certainly can. Yeah.
No.
Yes.
No, though.
It's Ian's job next time you wire out.
No, I wouldn't trust him.
Just call Jay.
Right.
Go to my doctor. 100%.
He'll walk you through it. No, that shit's painful.
All we do to take an IUD out is, so we put a speculum in so we can see what we're doing, but you just grab the strings with forceps and give it a kind of a firm, gentle tug, and it comes out. Like they're designed to be removed just by pulling.
Firm, gentle.
Well, I'm trying
tug.
To make it sound like it's not like being ripped out of your body. But,
yeah.
You know, essentially,
rip
just,
it right
you
on
just
out.
Grab the strings and pull. And it's kind of hard to do with your fingers. Like I've had IUDs that were expelling where I know they're expelling and my hand's already there. So I just grab the strings and pull on it. And, you know, the strings are slippery and you can't really see what you're doing at home, probably. But if you, you know, if you can kind of squat down and make yourself accessible and put a couple fingers up there, if you can get a good grip on the strings, you can pull it out.
Well,
here you go.
Nope. That's
you can do it, Ray. I believe.
Was that photo that went around on social media of the baby being born holding the IUD a real thing? Or is it like a faux and just funny?
I'm sure that's just funny.
It could be real. You can get pregnant with an IUD. It's not common, but especially if it's...
Well, and it's risky, right?
It's like
it is risky. Your risk of miscarriage goes way up. Your risk of infection goes way up. Your risk of preterm delivery goes up. But the risk of removing it if you're already pregnant is there too. You could raise your miscarriage risk, for example, by removing it. So, babies are born sometimes with the IUD still in place. I've heard stories of babies being born with the IUD stuck to their head, things like that. So it's not out of the realm of possibility.
Like stuck to their head surgically?
No. Just like you'd have a wet leaf stuck to your leg. So sure, it's possible. Was he born waving it around and saying, "Look what I found"? Probably not. But it's at least plausible.
So good. A little scary, huh?
I mean, even if it's possible, the idea of like trying to take my own IUD out just scares the shit out of me.
This is not, I guess, an official recommendation. Yeah. No, come give me your money. I'll take your IUD out.
Come give me your money.
I've only had one removed once because it was a swap-a-roo, I guess we'll call it. A switch out. She pulled it out and then like immediately put the other one back in. And it actually was way better than the first time I had it put in because it was just, my body was like already used to it. So I didn't have any like spotting or anything. Mm-hmm. It was awesome.
Did it make this noise?
I made that noise. No, I'm just
kidding. You're like.
No, it makes the noise of glass breaking.
Yeah. Are there physical signs of cancer in reproductive organs?
That's a hard question to answer. So cervical cancer, the Pap test is pretty good at picking that up before it turns into something that would cause symptoms. The ones that we worry about with the cervix usually is bleeding after intercourse is the red flag we kind of look at. But
like signs at home. Is that what we're talking about? Like, to the woman. I thought you were like... looking at reproductive organs does it look like?
No, I think this, I think the intention, this is kind of my guess, but the intention behind this question is
like at home. You
know, what would lead me to go get checked to make sure I don't
go every year, ladies?
But also like, could you tell? And I think this is because of like the age of the internet where everyone's like, oh my God, I have cancer and everyone's WebMDing all the time.
What cancer did Dr. Google say you have?
Exactly.
I've got I try not to lead in my doctor's appointments,
which means I'm dying.
I WebMD'd. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, my doctor.
Sometimes this is what I have.
Sometimes they know what they have and they're right. Not often.
Yeah. So bleeding during intercourse.
So bleeding with intercourse is a red flag for cervical problems. But that could just be a polyp that doesn't mean anything. That could be from a vaginal infection. That could be from chlamydia or gonorrhea.
Going a little rough.
Yeah, going a little rough can do it. You can get bleeding from tears too. So,
Melissa's face. I would love everyone to know Melissa's face.
Yeah, anywhere.
Right now.
If you poke it a little too hard.
Oh, God, you know, someone's being a little aggressive fingering. There's a lot of things that can happen.
Okay. Aggressive fingering.
I usually refer to those as mechanical trauma problems. But if you're having symptoms like that with bleeding with intercourse specifically, that's worth going and getting checked out. But it's almost never cancer. And cervical cancer really is not that common as far as cancers go. If we're just including things in the pelvis, ovarian cancer, if you have a tumor growing on your ovary, you can end up with this sort of feeling of bloating or fullness that doesn't go away. This sort of a persistent issue that's just on one side that doesn't go away, but that could just be ovarian cysts. That could be a digestive problem. Could be your appendix, you know?
Yeah.
Man, I was constipated once and I was sure that I had cysts or something.
And then cancer just came out.
Cancer landed in the toilet.
Like uterine and endometrial cancer is usually, again, I'm not an oncologist, but those are usually something where your risk goes up as you get older. But a sign of uterine issues is going to be usually the big red flag is going to be weird bleeding.
Okay, I have a question. At what point is it no longer suggested to be on birth control with like age?
When you are no longer worried about being pregnant.
So menopause? So,
menopause.
Okay. Because yeah. So, I remember when I was younger, I don't know if it's still the same situation, but it was like, I remember hearing, oh, as you get older, you should think about not being on like the pill or whatever.
Sure. And it's not as if there's no influence on your risk for, say, breast cancer or uterine cancer. You know, there are things that your risk can go a little bit up using birth control, but there are things that are reduced with using birth control too. And, you know, our usual view, at least my personal view, is it's less risky as long as you don't have those personal or family medical issues that are going to make you a sort of a more sketchy candidate for birth control. Mm. It's a lot less risky as a, say, 46-year-old to be on birth control than it is for you to get pregnant.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but until you are actually menopausal, you're still ovulating and you can still get pregnant. So,
yeah.
You know, our view, and again, I work at Planned Parenthood, where our main focus is helping women who don't want to be pregnant prevent pregnancy. So, you know, as far as we're concerned, it's better to just stay on birth control until you're hitting menopause. But honestly, guys, just tell your man to get a vasectomy.
Can you explain what a vasectomy like really is? I'm a little confused when people say like you're shooting blanks.
So.
Like I'm a little like I just
that's
don't quite get it.
That's legit. Yeah.
When a man and a woman love each other,
Cheryl's getting the talk right now.
A stork during the night puts sperm in the man's scrotum,
and then the stork is shot dead. Yeah. Is that what happens?
So I guess quick anatomy stuff as far as the male anatomy. So you have two testicles in the scrotum down there, and those testicles produce sperm.
Got it.
That's, you know, the man part of the DNA that swims to the egg and knocks on the door and says, can I come in, please, and make a baby with you? So
right.
Anyway, so the sperm, you know, it kind of collects down there. And then when you have when you ejaculate, it goes through these two little tubes from the testicles up near the bladder and into the urethra, and then they come out the penis.
Right. Those are the vas deferens, right?
Exactly, the vas deferens.
It's so weird when you can like feel those.
How deep are you getting into the ball situation?
Pretty deep.
She's just doing. She's
Would
doing
you say
his
it's
monthly testicular.
Balls
deep. Balls deep, definitely.
Doing his testicular exam form as a service, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you have a vasectomy, those tubes are cut. So the sperm is still being made, but instead of coming out through the urethra when you have ejaculation, the sperm just kind of stay in there, and then they degrade and just get reabsorbed. And
but I think
so
people with the balls get
anything.
Bigger.
Well, you're still shooting something, so you still have the fluid that comes out isn't just solid sperm. You have spermatic fluid. You've got the seminal vesicles that provide some of that liquid. You've got the prostate that provides some. I'm not a male urologist either. Mm. So I have my, you know, anatomy and physiology level understanding of this stuff. But
do you think like the balls then get like
larger?
There's
just no sperm.
And more mad. I feel like if you're just like cutting off their exit, what happens?
Right.
Yeah.
So this is the same question of what's happening if I'm preventing my period from occurring with birth control.
I kind of feel mad and angry in there too.
Right. So it's not like your uterus is a water balloon where if you're not having a period, it's just filling and filling and filling until it's going to pop.
You're just not.
It's just not making that lining build up. Right. Or it's maintaining it where it is. And it's the same thing with the testicles. It's not like they're hollow sacs that are just filling with sperm. And then at some point, they're
Kablow!
Just going to explode
forever.
And you're going to die. Regardless, ladies, of what your man says about his need for sex, it's not going to happen. It's not going to explode. So, so the sperm, you know, they're made and then they just break down.
Yeah, it's like the same thing with eggs. If they're not dropping down, mm-hmm. right, they're just getting reabsorbed.
Yeah, like, you know, you have a hysterectomy or something and they leave your ovaries, you're still ovulating, so you don't go into menopause early, but those eggs just sort of stay in the pelvis and break down. And
do you think like nocturnal emissions still happen if you have a vasectomy?
I assume.
I think
because that doesn't have anything to do with whether there's sperm.
I know. Well, yeah. That's why I thought it was more of the balloon situation and like kablow. I gotta make.
Don't think about sex. You might die.
I think the thing to keep in mind is like a lot of people think that sperm and semen and seminal fluid are the same thing. Mm-hmm. But you still produce seminal fluid. It just doesn't have sperm, and sperm right. Exactly. is what gets you pregnant.
Right. Yeah. So you've still like got the
whole new mystery.
You've
to me.
Still got yeah. the black powder and the firing pin, but there's no lead bullet. In the bullet.
Mm. I don't think I know enough about bullets for that like, to apply
you've
to
made
me.
This analogy worse.
And don't write in, guys. I know the firing pin is not part of the bullet.
That one man.
Who I was like, I have to go learn about guns like, yeah. and male anatomy.
We've encouraged our listeners in a direction we've never encouraged them to research before.
Sorry, guys.
Bullet.
Okay.
There's a very specific awesome. Reddit thread for that. So we'll go look it. That up. No, I'm just kidding. Do you help women with unexplained sources of pain? If not, what resources are there?
Depends on the pain. So I am pretty aware of my own limitations, and I'll be really upfront with women, especially with abdominal and pelvic pain, that there are only certain things I can check. So I can say if your uterus and ovaries are basically normal, I can see if there's something that's obviously causing the pain. There's a lot that I can tell from a bimanual exam. If I have a couple hands, one outside and one inside, you can see whether the pelvic floor is tender, where it might be a muscle thing, or you can see if the ovary is tender and enlarged, where it might be a cyst, or you can see if there's various things you can tell. But if my exam is normal and you're having abdominal pain can be caused by so many different things. And there's only the small set that I'm able to tell. So I can do a really good abdominal exam and say, well, it feels like you might have something going on over here and it's obviously tender. And I can percuss and say, oh, this feels, this sounds flat, which is not what we usually feel. Sometimes it's just constipation. And that's pretty easy to tell. But honestly, a lot of the time, if I can't find an obvious cause for pelvic pain, I'm sending those people to a primary care doctor or an OB.
What's the most common, generic, issue sure. that women are coming in with that's just like, oh, yeah, that happens. Here's constipation.
Yeah. So most of my day is preventive exams and women coming in with symptoms. So I have maybe, 20% that's procedures like IUD and implants. But for the most part, if women are coming in with symptoms, it is bacterial vaginitis. So they've had, a new sex partner and now they're having more discharge than they're used to and it doesn't smell the same, or they have sex and then it really smells afterward, which is a big, a big complaint of people with these types of bacterial infections. So I see that a lot. I treat it a lot.
Do you treat it with? Is it like antibiotics?
So there are a few different options. So the main sort of treatment that we usually use as a first line is a medication called metronidazole. And I guess if we want to get into the ins and outs of what's happening in bacterial vaginosis, we can. It's relevant to vaginal self-care and things too, because yeah. it can be triggered. So let's pull a metaphor out. If you pretend that your vagina is a beautiful flower garden.
Okay? I always do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Essentially what happens with the bacterial infection is it's not something that somebody gives you where there's a specific bacteria you get infected with. There's all sorts of bacteria in the vagina already, but the main one that keeps things healthy are the lactobacilli, right? Mm-hmm. That are the things that are in probiotics. So you have this nice, happy flowers that are living in there, making things smell good. But if those get kind of replaced with weeds, whether you, let's say you douche and you pull all your flowers out, or you have unprotected sex with somebody new and his fluids and your fluids kind of throw things off. The flowers go away. And if the flowers kind of go away, you have other plants that are always there that just kind of take over. And then all of a sudden it's not recognizable as your nice flower garden anymore. And it smells different and it looks different and it's unpleasant. Right. Mm. So the treatment for bacterial vaginosis, it's not like we're fighting, a pneumonia or something where you have bacteria where it's not supposed to be. There's always bacteria in the vagina. Mm. And essentially what we're doing is with metronidazole is it's like a weed killer where it kills the bacteria that have taken over, but it doesn't directly make your good bacteria come back. Mm. And so there's a lot of self-care principles here, because if you're, if you're the type of person who gets really uncomfortable with having anything noticeable going on down there that's different than usual, then there's a tendency for some women to do, you know, I'm just going to clean that out of there. They start douching to try and fix the problem, and that makes it worse.
I think it's just like, be careful about what you're putting down there. Cause I think you're right. Like, a lot of women are like, oh, I'm kind of itchy. Like, I'm going to go like slap a bunch of like products on there, and you just, and then you don't know like which of those products is causing it to be worse. And,
or maybe it's like not controllable by a wash.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, and you should see a doctor.
I have a long conversation that I have with patients that I recently made into a
PowerPoint,
a handout that I can just give them. But there's a whole set of things that we talk about with women whose main concern is that they have itching and irritation. But generally, the very best first step is just to stop using whatever you're using. Because even soap that you've used before and been fine with, if you have something that happens that breaks the skin down, that normal soap that you do fine with might not be fine anymore.
Yeah. Hmm.
But then once the skin heals up, you can start using the things you're using before and you're good again.
That's right. Nice. Our two questions from Twitter are like more not political related, but I guess, like, you know, there's a stigma around Planned Parenthood, mm-hmm. right? There's a lot of opinions about abortion and things going on in our country. So the first question is, how often do you avoid telling people where you work?
Not often. It's not like I'm going to walk around with a sign on my sign on my shirt.
I mean,
with a wooden sign.
He literally is wearing a Planned Parenthood.
I wear Planned Parenthood merch, right? So, and I'll get to that. So if people ask where I work, I say I work at Planned Parenthood as a nurse practitioner. Like, I'm not shy about it. I'm really proud of what I do. I love my organization.
Do you get negative reactions sometimes?
Sometimes. Like, so, and it kind of depends on the context. So, again, I'm not walking around with a bullhorn saying, I work at Planned Parenthood, ask me about abortion, you know? And I don't, you know, everyone's opinions about abortion are a little different. And you can be really, really strongly pro-choice and not love abortion as a thing. You can be really strongly pro-life and recognize that in the context of a, you know, restrictive culture where we kind of don't talk about sex and kind of blame people when they get pregnant, that there might be a need to have that as an option for women. So there's this whole range that you can't really put people into easy boxes about abortion specifically as a topic. But I'm not shy about the fact that I work at Planned Parenthood. I love my organization. I've never worked for anyone that cares as much about the people we serve as Planned Parenthood. I've worked in healthcare for quite a while. I worked as an RN at different jobs before I got my nurse practitioner license and started at Planned Parenthood. And it is great. I mean, we need to keep the lights on, but if I ever have an issue with a patient, the question I get from my boss is, did you take care of the patient? It's never, did we make enough money? It's never, you know, let's do everything we can to try and help our shareholders. It's, did you take care of the patient?
Yeah.
And the whole organization has that focus. It's all about serving the people that we take care of. It's not about the money, although we need to be able to keep running. But yeah, so I'm proud of the work that I do. I'm proud that I work for Planned Parenthood.
Another question we got from Twitter was, what are your Thanksgivings like? So I think the assumption there is like, do you have any super conservative relatives?
Oh, like conversations at the dinner table?
My Thanksgivings are great. I don't have a particularly conservative family. I mean, we're all like conservative-ish. Like, we grew up in Utah, at least us kids did. And, you know, I'm a proudly and very active member of the predominant local religious group. and I love it very much. But my mom was very open. I didn't realize how liberal she was until I was older, but we talked about sex at home. She asked if I had any questions. You know, I asked her when I was, I don't know, 7 or 8, where babies came from. And she gave me a very detailed idea of where babies came from. Not like a crazy explicit, but I walked away with it thinking that a woman walked into a hospital and laid down with her legs in stirrups, and a man came in and put his penis in like a vending machine, and then he left the room and a baby popped out. So it wasn't totally clear, but we could have those kind of conversations. I asked him what condoms were like, and you know, it wasn't weird for us to talk about things like that. And her the people that come to Thanksgiving, my parents host a very big Thanksgiving gathering every year, and we don't talk about politics very much. And if we do, everyone pretty much agrees with each other that about certain things. And
yeah.
So it's really not that big a deal. And I think, you know, the more that you know, Planned Parenthood specifically, the more that you know about what we actually do inside the clinics, the less the abortion issue is an issue.
What is the biggest misconception that you would want to clear up for the general public about
Planned Parenthood? One of the big ones, again, about the abortion issue is that we want women to have abortions. Like that we're advocating for people to have abortions and convincing women to have abortions. If a woman comes to us and she finds out she's pregnant, or she comes, she's already pregnant, we talk about all the options there are. Like, we have resources for prenatal care, for adoption. We have resources for all sorts of things, but we also give them information for if they want to end their pregnancy. But I think the thing that really would help is if people realized, first off, that most of what we do is routine women's reproductive health. Birth control is our main thing that we do. Birth control of every kind. We do vasectomies too. And $450, guys. I mean,
Worth a price. For that one man.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you have a long-term male partner and you don't want kids, do it. The other thing that I think I would like for people to understand is that our patients are not like some special class of woman who, you know, is making bad choices and desperate. They're like, it's your neighbors. You know what I mean? The women that I see are your neighbors and your daughters and your moms and your aunts and people of all different religious persuasions and all different life circumstances. You know, we take care of trans men and trans women. We take care of gay men and straight men, like the same as we would anybody else, you know? So the people that come to see us are just regular people that just need reproductive health care. And I think the more that we decide to stigmatize a whole class of people just based on where they decide to get their care, I think if we could get past that, it would really help out with the political situation and with, you know, helping to support the organization a little more. Because supporting Planned Parenthood in Utah especially really means supporting poor Utahns, which I think shouldn't be something that we have to fight so much about.
Yeah. What does your wife think about you looking at vaginas all day?
Mm-hmm. And my standard answer to that is that my wife likes that I have a job that pays our bills.
That's fair. Yeah,
and you know, it's important to realize too, like there's a real like mental switch that's flipped when you're in a professional clinical role that really you don't even have those kind of associations with the people that you're looking at. They're human beings with genitals. And honestly, I kind of refer to it as like, well, it's like ho-hum genitals. You know what I mean? It's just, it's just part of your body. It's
genitals.
Like, yeah, I mean, it's like if you're listening to someone's lungs, you're not thinking about their sexy back that you're looking at, you know?
Yeah, you're just listening to their lungs. You're compartmentalizing, you know, your life. And I feel like if you're a doctor and you're getting turned on by your patients, that's like a problem and you should probably not do that job.
That's what leads to prison.
Yeah.
Okay, so as the professional, what would you want your patients to do before they come in? Like,
cleanly-wise?
Sure. Like,
oh, that's a really good
question. Are there things like that you were like, you know, some what would preparation. Really help? A super scrub before
coming in. Throw some coconuts in.
Like, what are, or like, I, you know, prefer like tidy hair. I don't know. I mean,
do
you?
Right.
I don't know. I guess that's not really applicable.
Yeah, so ladies, if you could all braid, if you could all braid your pubes,
and put a little pixels on.
But is it easier to see if
so okay, so this is a pretty easy question to answer. So honestly, most of the time, I think my patients come in and they have showered ahead of time.
Sure,
that's great, you know. But if you're coming in with symptoms, honestly, the more you clean, the worse it is for me, because then I can't see what's going on. So if you're coming
like
in and you've been, it's like they're having discharge and they come in and like, oh, I just took a shower and cleaned myself out. I'm like, that doesn't help me.
Yeah.
But
can I see your old underwear?
Yeah. So if it's just a routine exam, honestly, it doesn't really matter. It's nice if there isn't a ton of BO, but I can ignore just about anything.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And there are all sorts of different grooming practices down there. Some people do no hair modification at all. Some people wax. Some people are completely shaved. Like, it's whatever it is, I've seen it and I don't really, it doesn't really matter.
Does it make it like faster? You're like, everything looks fine. I'm out.
It doesn't necessarily, especially because a lot of the hair removal stuff can cause skin problems that I then have to notice and then exclude as problems.
Yeah, interesting.
But really, you don't have to do anything different hygienically than you would normally do. Again, it's nice if your feet don't stink and your armpits don't smell, but I'm not going to say anything about it if they do.
Yeah.
Again, and just end it with the Febreze. Like, it was nice having you here.
Now, the exception to that is if you are coming because you're specifically worried about bumps and they're in a hair-bearing area of your pelvis, if you can do at least a little bit of trimming so that it's easy for me to see, then that makes it easier.
That makes sense.
But other than that, it's not really all that important. Just don't wash away anything you think I would need to see.
That's good to know. So don't put like concealer down there.
Don't throw glitter at it.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's kind of fun. When I see like glittery.
What? Like,
Yeah.
Where do you work?
Is it accidental glitter or is it purposeful glitter?
You don't need
I don't ask.
You don't need to dazzle
kind of,
her.
It's kind of fun if there's a little bit of sparkly stuff down there, but I'm not going to call attention to it.
He's like, this looks very nice that you've dazzled.
You've done a great job.
You can leave your piercings and stuff in and
oh my god, piercings, I didn't even think about that. I'm like, oh yeah.
You can leave your
maneuvering in place.
Like, I know, I always thought about that. Especially mine sits very low. And so I always am worried when they stick the speculum in that it's gonna like, I don't know, fling it somewhere or just like make it uncomfortable.
Almost all the time it just pushes it against the vaginal wall and
just lives there. It's fine. But I'm always like, should I just take that out for you? Do you want me to? I'll hold it up here until you're done.
Just like twirling it.
I'm like, wow, this is taking a while.
Well, this has been such an awesome conversation.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Seriously, thank you so much for hanging out with us. Thank you for answering these questions.
Thank you.
And so for our listeners, if you have some extra money and you want to donate to a good cause, or if you've ever benefited from Planned Parenthood services, please consider donating. It's super important. We're big proponents of Planned Parenthood. Is it just PlannedParenthood.com?
PPAU.org is the Planned Parenthood of Utah page.
And if you're not in Utah, find your whatever your local Planned Parenthood is and donate there. Mm-hmm. But if you're here, PPAU.org and donate.
And you should consider becoming politically active. You don't need to do a lot. You don't need to like picket at the Capitol. But honestly, a lot of your state legislatures, your state representative and senators don't get very many phone calls. There are bills that are run every year for comprehensive sex ed. There are bills run every year to remove the sales tax on menstrual supplies. There are bills. There's a bill that is going to be run this next session to have the state provide funding to help make up part of the shortfall for Title X clinics. And that's us in Utah. We're the only Title X organization historically in the state of Utah. So if you care about it as an issue and you want to do something to help, giving money is great. And we accept, you know, any form you can think of aside from like in-kind chicken donations or something.
Or like Bitcoin.
You find a way to take Bitcoin. You know, call your state representative and say, hey, I care about Planned Parenthood or I care about women's health care access. Let them know how you feel because they do not hear from a lot of their constituents about stuff like this.
It's a good reminder.
All right. Thanks again, everyone.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.